Morning, everyone.
Press the record button. Good morning, everybody. Today is March 21st, and I am kicking off the New Citizens Engagement Committee. It is 9:30. Let us start first with the Pledge of Allegiance. And Carol Downey, if you would please lead us.
Okay. Will everyone stand, please, for the pledge? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands,
one nation
under God,
indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, thank you very much, Carol. Elizabeth, would you please do a roll call?
Okay. Tony Alivato.
I'm here.
Okay. Elizabeth Busick here. Carol Downey.
Here.
Scott Fay. Elaine Genoway.
Present.
Sherry Horn.
Present.
Carolyn Inman.
Present.
Jim Levy.
Present.
Nalita Mendoza.
Present.
John Pointer.
Present.
Tony Rodella. No, Tony Rodella. Dave Tetzloff. Absent. Okay. And Evelyn Velez.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have only one new visitor, and I'm going to leave Jim to introduce her in a moment. So no further introductions. So let's just go on to our presentation. Jim, would you please introduce our speaker for today?
It is my pleasure and honor to introduce our guest speaker, Elizabeth Libby Anderson. Libby is the director of the Ombudsman Program at the Council on Aging in Southern California. He has served in this position since January 2016. Libby joined the Ombudsman Program as a volunteer in 2011 and then was hired by the program to serve as a regional coordinator in 2014. She is an attorney licensed to practice law in Illinois, where she was in private practice for 19 years prior to moving to the great state of California. Her practice areas included estate planning, planning for disability, guardianship for disabled adults, and elder law. Libby received her Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, and her Juris Doctor from Southern Methodist University, Dedman School of Law. It has been very meaningful working with the Office on Aging and having Libby share with us her comments regarding the Ombudsman Program and how it has helped residents living in nursing homes and long-term care facilities. Thank you, Libby.
Welcome. And before Libby speaks, I'd like to ask everybody else to mute during her presentation.
Well, thank you so much. And I don't know if all of you know, but Jim Levy served as an ombudsman for many years, and he's retired now. Jim, we still miss you. I hope you know that. But anyway, you added so much to the program, and you certainly impacted many lives. So I want to thank you for serving with us for so long. But I did want to talk with all of you a little bit today about the Ombudsman Program and what it is we do, and I will try and make it short and sweet, and give you time also to ask any questions that you might have about the program And I'd be happy to share some of our program's concerns with you as well. So am I allowed to, am I able to share my screen? I sure am. Okay. Let's see. Okay, hang on. Okay, hopefully you can see that. Okay, there we go. Takes me a while. You'd think I'd have this down after 2 years, but no. Okay, so as you know, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Ombudsman Program, and we are through the Council on Aging Southern California. Here's just a listing of the various other programs that we have within the Council on Aging. And certainly the Council is a multi-purpose, not-for-profit, so we do have a lot of programs under our umbrella. The Ombudsman Program is all about adult empowerment. And we want to make sure that abuse is prevented. And really, we're all about advocacy. We advocate for the rights and the dignity of those in long-term care facility, licensed long-term care facilities. And really, the Ombudsman Program has been around for a long time. It started back in the mid-70s. And it also started at the Council on Aging in the mid-70s. It is a federally mandated program as well as a state mandated program. So every state in the nation has an Ombudsman Program. They may look a little bit different than each other, but each state does have one. And they really started because there had been an increase in cases of abuse and neglect in what started out in nursing homes. So the program really started in nursing homes, but now, of course, is also within assisted living facilities. And we fall under the Older Americans Act. So again, as I mentioned before, we are federally and state mandated. So long-term care ombudsmen in Orange County go into over 1,000 facilities. Though that's a combination of nursing facilities and residential care facilities throughout the county. We have over 28,000 residents in long-term care. Actually, that number may have increased even. And as I mentioned before, those facilities consist of the nursing facilities. We have 75 nursing facilities here in Orange County. And then the larger assisted living, we have about 125. And then the rest are all six beds. The smaller facilities that are in neighborhoods that you may not even know they're facilities, but they're in your neighborhoods and in homes just scattered throughout the country, throughout the county. And we, as ombudsmen, we do create a presence by making unannounced visits to facilities to try and monitor the conditions, but we also investigate allegations of abuse and neglect. And when we need to, we refer the issues that we find to the appropriate licensing and regulatory agencies, because the Ombudsman Program is not the heavy. We are not able to cite, we're not able to levy fines, but we can refer matters of that need to be referred to, say, your community care licensing, which is the regulatory agency for the assisted living facilities, the six beds, or we can refer to the Department of Public Health, and they regulate the nursing facilities. And more than anything, we want to be a voice for residents, and we'd like to empower them to be able to speak for themselves. But if they can't, then we'd like to be there to be that voice. We do, as I mentioned, we investigate complaints and we report when we need to. Sometimes we have to report to law enforcement. And really we try to prevent elder abuse through education. Sometimes we will have occasion to go to facilities and give talks about resident rights, how those need to be observed, what those consist of, that type of thing. So that is part of what we do. The training that we go into, the one thing that is very, very important to ombudsman work is that we are resident centered. And so everything that we do has to be done with the consent of the resident, or if the resident isn't able to be to give consent, then we might look to a power of attorney or a representative, but we do things with consent. And again, we advocate for resident rights. When we give our training, we emphasize that certain topics. For example, maybe you knew this, but if a person is in a skilled nursing facility, an ombudsman has to be one of the witnesses of that document. And the reason why is because a lot of people in nursing care, they may be vulnerable, they may have health compromises. And so ombudsmen don't draft the documents. That's not what we do, but we will go in and we will talk with the resident and make sure that the resident knows what exactly it is that he or she is signing. We want to make sure they understand the importance of the document. We want to make sure that they aren't signing that document under duress or because somebody wants them to. We want to make sure they're doing that of their own free will. And we want to make sure that the person that they are appointing is who they would choose. Again, I'm sure you know that there are sometimes family conflicts and family members might not agree as to what should be in the document and who should be appointed. So in the end, we just want to make sure that the resident, that what is being signed is of the resident's choice. So that's by law here in California that an ombudsman must witness the advanced healthcare directive if the resident is in skilled nursing. And we also talk about other meetings that the ombudsman can attend. Mostly that is by invitation to a resident council meeting or a family council meeting or even a care plan meeting. So those are all situations where an ombudsman can be involved. And our ombudsman, once they're certified, because it is a state certification, then they are assigned their own facilities to go and cover and visit. And we try to visit the facilities, the 6 beds once a month and the large assisted living twice a month. I will tell you that's getting a little bit tougher because our volunteer base is shrinking. And I'm sure you can understand that COVID has had a real impact on our ability to recruit folks and even to retain, because COVID has just been terribly difficult. Certainly, one of the things that is foremost in my mind is keeping my ombudsman safe and healthy, as well as the residents. So there are a lot of new protocols in place due to COVID. The ombudsman are required to fill out a self-assessment every single time they go out into the field. They have to turn it in to me, and it indicates, it's just a whole checklist of questions as to how they're feeling. Do they have any fever, cough, sneezing, etc.? It lets me know where they are going. And that's important because if we ever have to do any contact tracing, then I will know where it is exactly that they have been. They do also have to test for COVID each week, at least once a week. I don't see that going away anytime soon, but that is something that they have to do. The other thing is they are all trained in how to both don and doff PPE. And that's, again, all about staying safe, because there has obviously been COVID within the facilities. And that doesn't prevent us from going in, but it's our training and knowing how to use the PPE that's going to keep us safe, as well as the residents, because, again, we don't want to be carrying things in. So COVID has had a big impact on the program, both the program requirements, but also the ability to recruit, because, you know, again, the long-term care facilities have been hard hit, and people know that. Oops, let's see. So as far as the skilled nursing facilities, those facilities we do try to get into once a week. There tends to be more problems there. And so, you know, again, it's just a place that we need to get into as often as we can. We get referrals from a lot of different places. Certainly a resident can call us or let us know that there's a problem. We hear from family members, we hear from friends. Facility personnel are mandated reporters, and so we do get reports from them on a regular basis. We get reports from Adult Protective Services, and we often have cases in common with them. They may have a person in the community who goes into the hospital and then ends up in a skilled nursing facility, and perhaps they want to follow that person to make sure that if they're discharged, that they're not going back into an unsafe situation. We get reports from financial institutions. Those are also mandated reporters. And unfortunately, financial abuse is on the rise, which is very unfortunate and also very difficult to deal with. And then we get crisis line referrals from the California State Ombudsman. When somebody perhaps has called the crisis line, then it comes back down to us if it's a facility in Orange County. The crisis line is a 24-hour service, and people know how to call the crisis line because there is an ombudsman poster in every single facility. That is... by law, there has to be these posters in the facility, and they list the local number as well as the crisis line number. I mentioned before that ombudsman must obtain consent before we proceed with investigating. And if we need to, we will refer matters to licensing agencies or law enforcement. We are all about confidentiality. There is nothing that will really, if we don't have the trust of the residents, they're certainly not going to report things to us. So we try to emphasize that confidentiality is of the utmost importance. It is all about the residents. And certainly we want to respect the residents and promote their decisions, their right to self-determination. Again, we just act to protect vulnerable individuals from abuse and neglect. And no matter who it is, if this person is in long-term care, we are happy to help them, to represent them. It doesn't matter how old, how young, what station in life they are from, what their lifestyle choices are. We are there for everyone. We do have continuing education. We have monthly in-services, monthly regional meetings. We have webinars. Boy, those webinars now during the Zoom era have certainly been on the rise as well. We have not yet started doing in-person meetings, although we hope to get back to doing that pretty soon. And these are all our different resources. As I mentioned before, the California Department of Public Health, community care licensing. Our local office number is here. And the Ombudsman Crisis Line is also here and happy to provide any of those. But that's about all I have about the program, but I am very happy to answer any questions that you might have. I'm going to stop sharing so I can see all your faces. There we go. And I did see something in the chat, but I haven't read it. Oh, okay. So I know that was a whole lot in a kind of a very short span of time, but I wanted to, I know you have other things in your meeting to discuss, but certainly just wanted to at least give you an overview of what it is that we do and how we do it. And Carol, did you have your hand raised? Carolyn, sorry.
Yes, my husband is in one of the six-person residential facilities. He mm-hmm. also is no longer allowed and partially able, but allowed is the more important word, to sign. So I don't think there's going to be any problem, but any person in that situation, what happens to your idea that they have to be there to sign for various things?
Well, we don't necessarily need a physical signature. Are you perchance your husband's healthcare agent? Okay. Yes. So if there was an issue, we would turn to you as the healthcare agent if he's not able to give the consent to move forward with something, with an issue that might be happening, we would consult with you.
That's what I would have guessed, but
yeah.
Checking. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, John. You're muted though.
There we go. Sorry. Technology. Libby, my name is John Pointer. I was just wondering if the council takes a position on legislation since you're a nonprofit.
No, not really a formal position. I will say, for example, through my program, the Ombudsman Program, we really are not able to, you know, do anything like lobby, things like that. We sometimes do meet with legislators. We really feel like that's more of an education that we're trying to provide of what resources are out there. Many times legislators don't have any idea about the Ombudsman Program and what it is that we do. So that's why we like to meet with them and let them know, hey, this is a resource for your constituents who are in long-term care. Sometimes there are legislative pieces that come up that we have an interest in that affect long-term care residents. We might talk with a legislator about it, but we don't really, you know, again, we don't really lobby per se there, you know, but there are certain issues that tend to come up now and again that, that we care about because they do affect our residents. And so we might discuss those.
Well, then, I'm not going to quote the actual bill number, but there's a proposal out there to extend the visitation schedule on nursing homes, if they're in good standing, and focus resources on those that are not. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's a good thing.
What do they mean extend? What does that mean?
I think the extension, rather than 24 months, I think is 30 months.
For visitation?
Yeah, yes. I tell you what, Libby, let me don't put you on the spot.
I'll call you. Okay, I'd be happy to talk to you about it. Yeah. I'm not sure. We talk a lot about visitation, but when I think of visitation, I'm thinking of people being able to visit their loved ones in
long-term care. No, it's you folks. It's you folks that act, It's the ombudsmans that actually visit the nursing homes. So I'll call you. Sorry to put you on the spot. Okay?
It's no problem. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Today's a wild day, so it won't be today. It'll be tomorrow. Okay.
No worries.
Thank you.
No worries. And if you want, I can put my in the chat. I'm going to put my phone number.
Great.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. John actually is going to have to leave now, but...
Okay, I'll type quick. And that's my direct line. There you go.
Thank you, Libby.
You bet. Thank you.
Jim. You're muted, Jim. Jim, you're muted. You're muted. You're still muted. There we go.
Sorry about that.
There you go.
There is an assembly bill by Assembly Member Curie, which is being heard today in the Assembly Health Committee, AB 1809, which is sponsored by Canner, C-A-N-H-R. I think you know them.
Oh, yeah.
And they seek to, and this bill seeks to codify and expand the rights of nursing home residents to give or withhold information, informed consent for being given a psychotropic drug. Are you familiar with this bill, and is anything being done by any of the people within our organization to be heard at some of these meetings? When they're testifying?
I know, Jim, I don't know if you remember CalCOA, which is the California Long-Term Care Ombudsman Association, and headed up at this time by Lisa Coleman. And Lisa, she certainly keeps her finger on the pulse of legislation. She is up in the Sacramento area, and she oftentimes does attend hearings, sometimes testifies at hearings. In there are certainly times and bills that we feel are important enough to go and state our positions on, specifically with respect to that bill 1809 that you just talked about. I don't know if we've taken or if CalCOA has taken a formal position on it. We actually do have a meeting, a legislative meeting this afternoon, so perhaps I might get a little bit more information about the bills that we're taking some positions on. But, you know, to your question, yes, if it is something that we feel like is important enough, we do send Lisa to the Capitol to be able to testify and or even just to listen.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions for you. You talked about cases and sort of overlapping with adult protective services. So what kind of cases do you handle? Because I thought that maybe you just heard the issue and referred it, but there's more involved.
So, you know, again, it's one of those situations, or a lot of times Adult Protective Services may have been called in on a situation that happened in the community and while the person was still at home. And for the situation got to a point where that person ended up in the hospital and then was not able to go back home due to the health condition and ended up in a skilled nursing facility. And that might be a situation where a person is coming from a home that there is abuse going on. So even though now that person has shifted into the ombudsman jurisdiction because he or she is in a nursing facility, it may come to a point where that person, the facility is saying, well, you're well enough to go home. And so Adult Protective Services is often interested if that person is discharged because they may be going back into a bad situation. And so that's how we do overlap.
I see. Okay. Sherry, you have your hand up and you're muted.
Yes, thank you. It's such a difficult job that you have, and I really appreciate you doing it. I've worked with and for boarding cares for chronically psychotic and schizophrenic people from 18 to 58. And almost everyone has conservatorships there. And one of their biggest complaints is that we make them take their medication. I mean, they are always calling the police and the fire department, charging us with forcing them to take their medication, but they have to take their medication. And so medication is a contentious issue and violent things happen in there. So I guess you train your ombudsman on defensive procedures too. I know we had a lot of training about managing assaultive behavior and different ways to interact with clients in crises. Yeah. It's just a really difficult, I didn't know if you send the same ombudsman into those facilities as you do for these senior facilities.
So we don't go into facilities where they're really psychiatric. We're really for those that are in, you know, like the type that I've mentioned in the past. And it's generally a population that is, you know, over the population that you're talking about. But I will say we do, And it is a problem, and I know that you'll relate to this, where there are people who sometimes do have a psychiatric diagnosis and who are volatile, and they are placed in, say, a skilled nursing facility with people who do not share that the same diagnosis, and the populations really don't meld well together. It can be difficult. It can be really difficult to manage a resident who does have those issues and who is in with other frail elderly people. And that is a problem, but no, we don't typically go into those facilities where it's mostly just a psychiatric, diagnosis and treatment that's going on. But I agree with you in the sense that medication merry-go-round is so tough that sometimes the medication really doesn't make them feel very good. And then, or it makes them feel fine and then they feel they're cured and then they go off. So it's just, that's a toughie for sure.
Another question that I have, you said that there were 1,000 facilities and 75 nursing, 125 assisted living. So that leaves 800 facilities that are less than 6 beds.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. You are so right. There are a lot of 6 beds.
Is there anything, so they're not maybe officially covered by the ombudsman program, but what resources do those people have if there's a problem?
So we do go to all the boarding cares, the small ones.
Oh, good. Okay.
So they are all covered. I say that, and again, I think I mentioned that we're a little thin with respect to volunteers, but if we receive a complaint, it will always be covered. We will go out and we will investigate.
They too have the poster with your phone number.
They do. And that's actually one of the things that we check for when we go in, is we make sure that the poster, it is supposed to be in a prominent place. And it's huge. It's a really big poster. It's kind of ugly. It's just sort of this tan and kind of light green. It's really not very attractive, but it's big and it has our telephone number and as well as the crisis line. And it does let them know how they can reach us. And that's either the resident or their family member or anybody else. But we do check. We don't want to see it like in a closet door, you know, inside the closet. It's supposed to be out where people can see it.
Okay. I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
I understand then that there are there is a chain of nursing or a chain of assisted living places. Any of those owners that have multiple facilities, if you have any that you identify an issue with, is there some special attention that is paid to checking the other facilities?
No, not necessarily. I mean, not unless we know that there might, you know, that there's a red flag in another one. I guess, although I will say there's one, operator who we tend to sort of be a little bit worried about in the nursing facility arena, but with respect to like the large assisted living and those chains, we haven't found, and I certainly haven't heard that if there's a, you know, an issue going on in one, there might be one, the same issue going on in another. I will tell you there is one issue that is, it's throughout. It doesn't matter if it's nursing, large assisted, or the board and care, and that is that staffing is really, really a problem right now. Like really a problem. So that definitely has affected resident care. We are hearing just terrible stories about people, you know, the call bells, they're not being answered. If they're being answered, the issues aren't being addressed. We are hearing a lot of people who aren't being turned, more skin care issues, and it's all as a result of staffing. So that's a biggie right now, but certainly not, it's not limited to just, you know, one or two.
Carol.
What if you find a facility that is in violation of things like that, and you report them? Do you report them to the state? And if so, what can the state do? What does the state do about it?
So the state, if we refer an issue to, say, the California Department of Public Health, again, that's for the nursing facilities, they will, and this is true of community care licensing as well, they will open up an investigation of their own, and they will go and find, just look into the situation and see if it merits any type of action on their part. And unfortunately, as I mentioned before, we aren't the ones who can do any citations or anything like that. All we can do is report it further and allow those regulatory agencies to do their what they do. And, you know, sometimes, and this is can be a real frustration, sometimes we see things and we report them and then they might go out and not substantiate them. And I mean, that's that can be very discouraging, but it doesn't stop us from continuing to report when we feel like we need to. It's the thing, you know, in the assisted livings and the six beds, I mean, there really isn't, they don't require a real high staffing level. So it's like the bare minimum that they can get away with. And that again translates into very poor care. And right now, because of COVID, the nursing facilities are, you know, are trying to get it such, or they are allowed to have fewer, the level can go down as far as what staffing is required there, because there is just such a staffing shortage. So it's called the staffing shortage waiver. And that, again, that doesn't translate into good resident care. So I don't know the answer, but all we can do is continue to try and advocate and try and refer as much as we can and get those situations investigated by those who can do something about it.
I have one last, sorry, Elaine, go ahead.
In regards to the staffing shortage, is it a greater issue in Orange County due to our cost of housing, or is this nationwide? What is the?
It's certainly all over California. It's everywhere. And it's, you know, COVID, this is kind of one of those situations where, for example, the staff in the facilities have required vaccination and boosters, and not all people want to do that. And that has affected staffing. And it's such a double-edged sword because the facilities are like, well, you know, if we could sort of kind of pull back on that, then we wouldn't necessarily have the staffing shortage. But again, the COVID hit the facility so, so hard. And it has been shown that vaccination has certainly helped that situation. So if you're not gonna require vaccination, you know, are you gonna set yourself up for more COVID? Because, unfortunately, in that first round, it was staff who were bringing it in. Mm-hmm. I mean, residents weren't necessarily going places. So after vaccination, after we had the first two rounds, it went down significantly. And even now with, COVID kind of ebbs and flows. We get these variants and this and that, but it has shown that people, that at least, you know, unless they have other comorbidities, are not ending up in the hospital. But our skilled nursing folks, they are very, very vulnerable. And so we don't want COVID in there. So the vaccination has been important, but it has affected staffing.
Okay, thank you.
One of the things that Jim brought to our attention during the kickoff of the COVID crisis was the fact that the ombudsmen were no longer allowed to go into the facilities. Mm-hmm. And so when there is another similar kind of situation mm-hmm. where there is a complete shutdown, is there something that is the ombudsman program now prepared to deal with that? I mean, do you have protective equipment? Do you have, mm-hmm. would you be able to handle things differently this time around?
You know, I think so. I really do, because I think that we have all recognized the harm that came to the residents when everybody was out, nobody was allowed in. And we're prepared now. We, you know, as I kind of described before, you know, we're testing, we know how to use PPE. We were trained, we had, you know, consulting firm come in and show us how to do it. We were fitted with N95s. We are ready. And I think we feel very, very strongly that the residents need us, and that we need to be there to be their eyes and to be the eyes and ears. Because I can tell you, we tried really hard to get back in there as soon as we could. Mm-hmm. Of course, at first, you know, nobody knew, we weren't prepared. And it would have been dangerous for us to have been going in. But mm-hmm. I think we're prepared now. I mean, we have had the training. We know it's not necessarily the same gig where you don't go in and you hug your resident anymore. You don't do that. You keep distance. You wear your PPE. You wash your hands. You use hand sanitizer. You do all that stuff that keeps them safe and that keeps us safe. And it is, I'm not going to say that none of us caught COVID, because that's not true, but it wasn't necessarily from a resident in a facility. It just, you know, that happens. But I do think that we're prepared, and we certainly aren't prepared to let our residents go through what they went through before.
Great. Okay. And finally, just, is there anything, we try to ask all of our speakers, is there anything that we could do as advocates for the senior community and having a voice with the Board of Supervisors that would facilitate your job?
You know, more than, I guess, more than anything, we want people to know that we're there, that we are a resource. And I think as hard as we try, we not everybody knows that we are there. Even though there's the big poster, that doesn't necessarily mean that they know who, what exactly an ombudsman is. So really just kind of to promote awareness of the program, and also to recognize that it is an important program. It's very important for those residents, I think, to have an advocate. And so we need the funding in order to do that. So any support for our funding is certainly appreciated. We recognize that we've been very fortunate to have gotten very generous funding in the last couple of years. That hasn't always been the case. Jim, I'm sure you remember back in 2008, I think it was, maybe 2007, 2008, when the program's funding was completely cut. And that was pretty devastating. So, you know, we have been able to build back some of the funding, but without it, we certainly can't do our jobs adequately. So just awareness of our program and support in terms of funding, and any volunteers who who would like to join us, I'm so proud of my team. I really am. They're people with heart. There are people who care, you know. And so, yeah, I think that's about it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Libby. This was a terrific presentation. We really appreciate it.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And I did put my phone number in the chat. If you'd like to talk to me just one-on-one, well, I'm happy to do that.
Okay, great.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I think Jim's trying to say something, but he's muted.
One final comment. As an ombudsman, I can say that there's been some very positive things that we have seen that have taken place because of the ombudsman program with individuals. And unfortunately, there's been some things that we just couldn't do because of the laws and so forth and so on. But I can really say that from the perspective of a former ombudsman, it's very encouraging of what this program has done to help people who are living in nursing homes and these 6-bed facilities. So we thank you again for all that your organization has done.
Thank you. All right. You all take care. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Libby. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Tony, I just want to also, this is Tony Olivato. I just want to say how much we enjoyed having your substitute come in while you were out.
Yeah, we got a lot of help from the cats.
Yeah.
There's three of them, you know, so some of them were more engaging than others.
Well, that one seems to be very interested in the topic.
And everything.
Okay, Jim, thank you so much for bringing Libby to the meeting today. We're moving on to the chair items. We just have some old business. Wanted to review the next presentation. Well, Jean isn't here, but the next presentation, I believe, is on fraud. Is that correct? And I can't flip between my various pages fast enough. So I will follow up with Jean just to make sure that, or is it Social Security?
Evelyn?
Yes.
This is Tony. I was a little late. I had difficulty getting logged in. Got in. Anyway, I've contacted Jeffrey. No, I'm on for, supposed to be on for May. However, I've been trying to get a hold of Jeffrey Rodriguez from Social Security. For a month or so, we played phone tag, and then I've emailed him, and so he's never emailed me back, whether he's accepted or he can do it or anything. So that's where I'm standing right now. I'm still going to send a couple more emails and find out if he can make a presentation for May. But like I said, it's very difficult not having a phone number, you know, because of that. And also, but I've had his Social Security email, and I've left numerous messages on his email, but I hadn't had any return on those.
Tony, has he ever responded to your email? I'm just wondering if the email address you have is typed in correctly. Maybe you should take it out and put it in fresh, because I know usually he responds pretty quick when I send it.
No, I have jeffrey.rodriguez@ssa.gov, which is the one that has on our list of members.
Yeah. Well, what I'm suggesting is rather than letting it autofill on your, when you send him an email, put it in fresh. Sometimes there's a character space that gets in there that we don't see if you're having trouble, if you don't know that he's receiving your emails.
Okay, I'll do that again. But like I said, I do, after the second time that he didn't respond, I did go back, and when I typed it in, I made sure that it was correct. But okay. I'll do it again, no problem. I'll keep at it.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the other thing was an update on the status of senior centers. I don't know. Oh, yes. Is that Elizabeth? Are you raising your hand? Or you?
Yes, I am. I am.
At the beach again.
According to the presentation schedule, April 18th is fraud, elder abuse by Sergeant Vogel, V-O-G-E-L. Jean is the coordinator.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
And then May is the speaker is Jeffrey Rodriguez, and it's SSA with a question mark.
Right. Okay. And he was going to talk to us about fraud if Tony can get a hold of him.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Updates on the status of senior centers? Anything anybody wants to share there? Just a reminder that we want to have two-way communication with our senior centers. We want to be able to represent any issues or concerns that they also raise. Okay, we have new business. And Desiree, do I really need to do the action item? Because you told me that we don't have to have a special meeting.
We do need the action item to get us through to the next meeting. We just don't have to meet again to vote for in between meetings.
Oh, okay. Well, that was good news.
Kind of good news.
Okay, so then the action item is AB 361, review and make findings required by Government Code subsection 54953E3. And the recommendation is that we continue virtual meetings due to the proclaimed state of emergency arising from COVID-19, as meeting in person presents imminent risk to the health and safety of attendees, and the emergency continues to directly impact the ability of members to meet safely in person. Do I have a motion to continue to meet virtually? Jim?
Second. Thanks.
And a second by Sherry. Thank you very much. Desiree, would you please take the
of course. Tony Alavado.
No.
Elizabeth Busick.
Yes.
Carol Downey.
Yes.
Scott Feig. Elaine Genoway.
Aye.
Sherry Horn.
Yes.
Carolyn Inman.
Aye.
Jim Levy.
Yes.
Nalita Mendoza?
You left a 10.
Okay. John Poynter? Tony?
Bye-bye.
Tony Rodella?
Aye.
Dave Tetzlaff?
Aye for the last time.
And Evelyn Velez?
Yes.
And that is majority chair.
Okay, great. Thank you. Subcommittee reports. The Digital Divide Subcommittee. Dave, I don't know if you guys have had a chance to meet, if you've had any further discussions.
No, let me first apologize for getting in late. I cut the cable, I've got a new provider. And so this was the first time I tried to get into Zoom with my new provider. And I found out there's some additional challenges, but I apologize for arriving late. But no, we have not met. I'm trying to get a meeting together for forthcoming short order. There's two topics that I think we can discuss within the tech committee. One possibility is developing a survey in regards to the distribution of the iPads, how successful it was, if there's any problems that we should be aware of. The second item is what I would call developing an Orange County Digital Connect score. And during the last 4 or 5 months, there's a lot of factors that I've seen that have come up that would be beneficial to the county in regards to analyzing the digital divide in Orange County. And interesting point, I just was reading an article last night in regards to, I think it was by the Orange County Register, which was rating the cities by safe, by crime rating for the cities. And one of the new factors that was involved in that was the internet connection by within the city as a factor in regards to rating the safety of cities. And so I think that's becoming a greater factor in regards to analyzing the safety of the neighborhood that you live in. And so I think we can explore that. I think part of one of our original proposals long-term was to develop an analysis of the internet connection and internet divide. So this is becoming more and more of a factor for the future. I notice in cities, they've got a walking trail rating. Is this something that should be considered for Orange County as far as a digital divide rating? But you know, I'm more positive and I would call it a digital connect rating versus a digital divide rating. So those are the couple of items that I want to discuss with the committee that we can follow up with this committee and with Erica, the Office on Aging. So that's a report for today.
Okay, so—
Any thoughts with anybody in regards to those two subject matters? Let one of the committee members know. Well, and we are trying to meet in person. We're getting tired of the digital divide between person to person and Zoom to Zoom.
Yeah, so. No kidding.
You just really want the donuts. That's all you're talking about.
The apple strudels in McDonald's. It's good.
Okay, David, let me just say that I found out that Lillian Maruta is actually our liaison with the Office on Aging. And she is here to help us with not technical, but data collection, any special questions that we have. So I encourage you to reach out to Lillian.
Okay.
Lillian, if you would email David.
I'll put my email address in the chat then, and that would be great.
Perfect.
Can you put me your phone number then too?
Yes, definitely.
Email address and phone.
I will.
All right, thank you.
And I think it would be terrific to find out, I mean, before you start trying to fix something, you need to try to figure out how big of a problem is it. And we know it is a problem for the state. How big of is the problem in Orange County, and is it in specific areas? So I think that's a great approach that you're taking there.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we did have a meeting for Elder Abuse Subcommittee. This was our first meeting, and that's when we found out that Lillian is available to help us on various issues. And what we talked about was that October is Domestic Abuse Month, and we'd like to do something during October, but that June 15th is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. And Lillian has forwarded us a wealth of contacts, of data that is provided by the World Elder Abuse Society, not quite sure what their name is, that has templates, flyers, press releases, and things like that. What we had talked about was that one of the major issues was kind of the awareness of it, and what do you do if you suspect there's an issue for a neighbor, for example, or a family member, and what are the resources and the programs that are available offered here in Orange County or nationwide. So we will be asking, we'll probably just have another Zoom meeting with Lillian, perhaps to talk about the resource that she sent us and how we can get that out. Lillian, can you talk to us a little bit now about what you would be doing? You sent us the link for the World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, but is there something that the Office on Aging plans on doing at this point?
Yes, Evelyn. Regarding, I know that on the email, there were several questions that was also asked, and you guys mentioned that you guys know very little about the topic. So in my email, I think I was inquiring what information you're looking for so I can better assist you guys, because I have a whole bunch of contacts, whether it be social services or the elder abuse prevention or APS, and also the police department. I'd be happy to gather all that information, but I think I needed more information from you guys as to what information you guys were looking for besides collateral or publications for distribution. We do have, with the Council on Aging, there is an elder abuse prevention program, and then they also meet with a whole bunch of organizations such as APS, social workers, the DA's office, along with the police department to work succinct with one another, just to help with residents and also legal matters as well. As Libby has mentioned, the the uptick in financial abuse is quite high. And not only that, but also other types of abuse, but the majority of it is mainly financial, and people trying to take over to be the power of attorney, getting into the trust funds and whatnot. So if you guys can let me know what kind of information, I'd be happy to assist with that.
Okay,
in regards to the Awareness Day, I did provide you with the resources and also the bulletin. And normally what we do is that we blast it in social media, we put it on our website, and we share that with our providers as well. And I reached out to our providers to see if anybody is doing any special events, and I'll report back once I hear from them.
Okay, great.
Evelyn, I have a question on the subcommittee. Was that the subcommittee that Carolyn and Elizabeth were on, and did I miss that meeting?
Yes, you missed that meeting.
I'm sorry, I didn't know.
I sent you an email and I didn't hear back from you, so I sent you.
Oh, really? Email. Oh, okay.
I'll double
check. I'm sorry.
My email. That's okay.
I don't remember ever seeing it, but okay. I'm sorry. I didn't know.
You can, if you want, you have my email address. You can email me and I can make sure that I am emailing to the right place.
Okay. Yeah, I will do that because okay. It might be. Yeah, I will do that. Okay. Sorry, Evelyn.
Right. Evelyn, what day in June is World Awareness Day?
I'm sorry. What did you say, Tony?
What is the date in June for the World Awareness Day?
June 15th.
June 15th.
Yes. Thank you.
So Evelyn, I'd be happy to get on a call with you in the work group after this or to set something up. I'd be happy to do that as well.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Carolyn, do you have your hand up?
Well, I had one question. June 15th isn't very far away, so it couldn't be a huge thing, but would it be possible to send a short version of your packet to every senior center? If it had something like a flyer they could post, or if you know somebody who needs help, call this, you know, whatever is available.
We can do that. You're talking about the information on the toolkit?
Right. Now, it just seems like I've never seen anything in our senior center about this issue. You know, and I think that obviously it's very important. And in domestic abuse, they sometimes have a rather small sort of thing that says, if you need help, or if you know someone who needs help, so a person can pretend they're taking it for somebody else, and they're really perhaps taking it for themselves. But if we could get something that is easily put on the wall or whatever to get to every senior center, you know, it might do a little bit of good as a start.
Okay. We could do that.
I'd like to look at that toolkit because it had a lot of flyers and things like that.
Right.
So let's just get together for another little Zoom meeting and we'll include Lillian in it. Get some ideas going. Thank you very much, Carolyn and Elizabeth, for your input. It was a very productive half hour.
Also, when you look at the information that you want to get out to the senior centers, you may want to coordinate that with Cynthia Thacker to send out to the senior center liaisons so that all of SCAC can cover all the senior centers in the county.
Okay, thank you. All right, moving on then, legislative tracking volunteer. John had to leave early. Tony, not to put you on the spot, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add or say to that?
No, there's nothing new as far as.
Okay, thank you. New membership, no new members. Announcement and roundtable discussion. Does anybody have announcements for today? No? Okay, great. Public matters. So at this time, members of the public may address the council regarding, and there is one member of the public. Regarding any items within the subject jurisdiction, provided that no action is taken on off-agenda items unless authorized by law. Desiree, would you check with our attendee?
Yes, we did not receive any comments ahead of time. If there are members of the public this morning that would like to address the committee, please use the hand raise icon or press star 9 and I will unmute you. And I'm seeing no hands, Chair.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate everybody coming. Our next meeting is on Monday, April 18th at 9:30. Have a great rest of the week.
Have a good one.
Everyone.